Hello and welcome to the Brain Palace. I am aficionados Chris, and I'm here with my co-host,
Invidinja, otherwise known as Ollie, as always.
Yes, and today we're actually re-recording an older episode because we wanted to let this movie sink in a little more, since when we recorded last time it was a little too fresh in our minds.
I think the thing is, as well, there was a fair few technical problems, and once again, things came up. I say, for this episode, this is sort of the first of our quadrilogy of spooktacular movies that we want to pick for before Halloween, because, well, everybody else is doing it.
Yeah, we're sort of late in the game, since it's already the 22nd. But without any further ado, Ollie has picked a canon film, I believe, for the start of the Halloween spooktacular, whatever you want to call it, a little space vampire movie called Life Force. I'm going to let Ollie give a little more backstory into it, since he's better at that.
Life Force from 1985, directed by the same luminary who gave us the Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Poltergeist, Toby Hooper. Now, Life Force began as essentially the first project that Toby Hooper, who was assigned to do this by Canon Films. Essentially, Canon and Golden Globus, Menahem Golem and Yoram Globus, the two cousins that took over Canon Films in the 80s, essentially were able to buy the rights to a late 70s novel by the name of The Space Vampires, authored by Colin Wilson. And essentially they wanted to create their own massive science fiction epic. In the original American posters, the tagline was the sci-fi event of the 80s. And at the time, I believe this was the biggest budgeted film that Canon had ever made. Bear in mind, much of their projects, like American Ninja and the early Death Wish movies, were made on budgets of around 1, 2, 3 million, so they could make back as much profit at the box office as they could. Life Force, on the other hand, was considerably more expensive at the time, a whopping $25 million. And bear in mind as well, the actual crew behind the film, before we were even meant to get into the cast, already they were touting a lot of the big names behind it, not just with Toby Hooper, but you have composer Henry Mancini doing the main score, John Dykstra doing the special effects, who was the same guy who won several Oscars, and originally worked on the Star Wars films. So you already have quite a bit of money behind it, not to mention a group that is already well known because of their past projects and of course their future projects 2 years after this. What were they going to make? Masters of the Universe and Superman 4. So yeah. That's a good way of putting it.
Superman 4 and Masters of the Universe.
Two of the greatest films of 1987. Come on.
No.
It was a damn good year. Also American Ninja 2, just because. Probably one of the best years for canon? Maybe. Although 1985, when this one was made, pretty damn close. Especially with Death Wish 3 and American Ninja 1 in the same year.
Well, maybe. Just Masters of the Universe, just no.
No, you're just a boring old sod.
Maybe I am, but you know what? I would rather see He-Man be played by an American.
Let her go! Come on, Dolph Lundgren's voice, that thing is just fucking classy. Anyway, before we get off topic, I might as well try and describe the plot of Life Force, unless you wanted to have the honour.
I'll have you do it. You always do it better than me.
Very well. Life Force, I suppose to sum up as succinctly as Chris did at the very beginning, I could just say two words, space vampires. But I think that would be sort of undermining the general craziness that this film entails. It's set in present day 1985, and there is an Anglo-American space shuttle mission that is there to investigate Halley's Comet. Upon going inside the comet, they find a massive starship of unknown origin, and they go in and discover essentially a mixture of Hammer Horror Gothic architecture and H.R. Giger craziness. And what do they discover? Well, a lot of dead bat-like creatures, along with a tomb full of space vampires, essentially just naked humanoids in these sort of crystal capsules, one woman and two males. So what do? They decide to take them back to Earth, and essentially, all hell breaks loose. Most of the crew of the Churchill, the mission that was originally sent out to get them all dead, burnt alive to a crisp. The vampires escape and cause just mass havoc throughout the city of London, and there's a lot of crazy plots going back and forth about the main characters, which we'll get into a bit. That's essentially the gist of the movie. It's like Alien meets the Quatermass in the Pit, meets the day the Earth caught fire, / 28 days later. I think that's the best way to describe it in as simpler way as possible.
And I love that you said Alien, because one of the, I think the writer was one of the writers of Alien, if I was not mistaken.
Yes, half of the screenplay was written by Dan O'Bannon. Some people would consider it not his finest moment, but then again, when you have source material that's as pulpy as this, it's hardly surprising.
And, again, you said it's based on a book, and didn't you start reading the book recently?
I've read about halfway through the novel, and the source material, the plot is essentially the same, but there's a few key differences. There's more than three space vampires, and it's actually set in the far future. It's not set in present-day 1985, it's set in the 22nd century. So, but it's still set in London, which predominantly the film version is also set.
Well, I guess they decided to go with present-day to keep the budget at a minimum.
Yeah, I mean, mind you, I have to wonder what kind of would be like if they did a full-on space opera. Can you imagine them doing, instead of, okay, Robotech the movie, instead of doing it animated, let's do a live-action Macross movie on a budget. That's something I'd love to see, or I'd love to have seen.
That would have been interesting. It could have ended up like He-Man. Probably.
It would have ended up like He-Man, but to be honest, that to me would just have been genius anyway. But I suppose, what was your first impression of Life Force? Because as you said, I think this was only the second canon film you'd ever seen, and in that, you had never heard of the film before. So what was your first impressions of it?
Well, I wouldn't say I never heard of the film. I was familiar with its existence, because Aaron Eisenreich owned a copy. I thought, what the hell is that? And then you brought it up again years later. I was like, oh yeah, I remember him pulling that out one time. But first impressions, I guess, I was really enthralled. Like,
so you remember him just...
Yeah, I remember him just putting it out.
Like, yeah, I mean, it's one of these movies where some people own it, but often forget they have it. Or indeed, some people really, really like to remember it and really wax nostalgic over it, but then most people don't seem to really care. It's a film of really... just weird binary opposite when it comes to criticism, because the film at the time was a massive flop. Because of its $25 million budget, it only opened 4th at the box office charts. It was actually beaten by another science fiction film at the time, which was Cocoon, which is actually one of my mum's favourite films.
I've heard of Cocoon. I probably should check that out one of these days. But as far as my impressions of Life Force, if I remember, my first canon film was Invasion USA, which is not a good film, but then again, what is a good canon film? But I remember really getting attached to Life Force within the first 10 minutes, because obviously the budget showed that it had much more effort put into it than any other canon film that I saw.
Yeah, the special effects lack a lot of the really terrible green screen and set design that you would see in stuff like, say, Superman 4. I mean, there's no weird black curtains that you could see in the background and wind flowing through space. They actually put in effort when it came to the special effects this time round. I mean, and it did really show just from the opening frames. I mean, just hearing Henry Mancini's opening score over the opening credits, you don't feel like you're about to watch a film by the Golden Globus group. You feel like you're going to watch something a bit classic. A bit more of an edge to it, I suppose you could say. And believe it or not, that kind of edge gets a little crazier over time. In fact, I dare say it, not a little crazier, extremely crazy. Extremely crazy to the point of almost incoherence.
Well, I would say is that, like, as far as canon films go, from the ones that I've seen, this is probably my favorite of all of them.
Before I get into my end opinions of the movie right at the end of this episode, I will agree with you in that respect. It's one of my absolute favourites. It's probably my second favourite canon film because, as you said, it had a lot of effort put into its production. Yes, okay, you can argue it's not particularly successful. In fact, most critics hated it because of its incoherence. Whereas, this is actually kind of funny, I discovered this on YouTube. You are aware of the critic Leonard Maltin?
Yes, he's actually one of my favourite critics.
He reviewed Life Force, you can actually find it on YouTube, and he said, it's so incoherent, but it's so goddamn entertaining. And I can't help but agree with him, that is my exact opinion of the film.
Well, see, Leonard Maltin is one of my favorite critics, because I very rarely disagree with him, because, just like me, he tries to find the good in every movie. A great example is that I believe Batman 66, the Adam West movie, was... it didn't get a lot of good reviews by critics, but I remember his short review was just good, campy fun.
Exactly. I think that's a good way to say a good opinion about this film. But I suppose to get into more detail, we've got to talk about some of our main characters. Our main protagonist, who bizarrely doesn't really appear properly until about half an hour into the film, is Colonel Carlson, an astronaut played by Steve Railsback of Turkey Shoot and X-Files fame, oddly enough. And essentially, he is the lone survivor of this Anglo-American space shuttle mission to bring back the space vampires. And what happens is, after being investigated by several people, including Kane of the SAS, played by Peter Firth of Spooks fame, essentially he discovers that he has a psychic connection with the main female space vampire who is essentially stalking the city streets of London, played by the voluptuous Matilda May, a French actress who in this film was in her early 20s, and it shows. If I could time warp back in time to 1985, I would propose to this woman on the spot, because she is gorgeous. My God. I mean, I remember when this was paraded on the internet at the time. I didn't get around to watching it until really fairly recently. But as a kid, you'd see, of course, pictures of this woman and, you know, they describe her. And you don't realise until you're much older how absolutely gorgeous this woman is. She's like Jennifer Connelly, but somehow even cuter. I don't know how two people got together and said, we're going to make a baby and we're going to make literally the most beautiful girl in the world. And somehow they did it. God knows, I have no idea, but I could sing my praises to high heaven how this woman is absolutely fucking gorgeous.
This whole podcast could be about you just praising this woman.
God, yeah, Matilda May, if you're out there, I love you, and I'll always love you because you're fucking gorgeous. Anyway, I suppose to get back on track, what happens really is the female space vampire escapes from where she is captured. She is captured by the International Space Centre of the City of London, and upon being analysed in an autopsy room, she wakes up from her deep cryogenic slumber and essentially goes around and stalks people. And by stalking people, I mean doing the usual vampire tricks. But not any usual kind of vampire trick in the sense of sucking out blood. They suck out something else, the life force of the title. How do they do this? Well, they don't bite people on necks like you'd usually see in a classic Universal horror fare or the Hammer horror fare. What do you get? Well, they essentially suck electricity out of your soul, Highlander style, which results in some of the most explosive set pieces in the movie, particularly later on, to hilarious effect. And once they suck out the life force, you essentially become this bizarre, charred skeleton. And some of the animatronics on these undead creatures, once the life force is actually sucked out, is particularly effective. Again, showing the budget of this film in abundance, really.
Yes, I remember, I think in the last time we recorded this, and I still hold by this, is that all the special effects are the showstoppers of this film.
Indeed. Essentially what happens is, after the first victim of the female space vampire, she doesn't ever have a name, she's often credited as just Space Vampire or Space Girl. The guy who's the first victim, he wakes up, and all of the animatronics are really fluid, like the movement of the arms and the hands and the eyes and the face. Essentially what happens is, this zombie dude essentially wants to give the guy who's doing the autopsy on him almost a nookie. It's like he's guiding the fingers towards him, almost like he wants a massive hug, sucking the life force out of this doctor and regaining his human body again. But the main plot thing with the vampires is they can only absorb life force within a 2-hour time limit, otherwise they crumble into dust very quickly.
Such a great film. But I guess we should go on with more characters, and one that I have to mention, because it's one thing that really shocked me watching this, because I tend to watch movies cold. I don't really look them up or watch a trailer. I just watch them and see what I like. But one thing that really stopped the show for me was Patrick Stewart's cameo.
Yes, he plays a mental hospital doctor named Dr. Armstrong. Essentially, within this aspect of the plot, Steve Railsback and Peter Firth are already on the trail of the female space vampires. She's killed various victims and has taken their forms. Again, no real explanation as to how she is able to take all these people's forms and leave her normal body behind. Well, they try to explain it at the end, but we'll get to that. They go to the mental hospital and find Patrick Stewart because they believe that one of the people in the hospital has been absorbed by the space vampire, or one of them, either way. And they discover that actually Patrick Stewart is the one who's been taken over, which results in probably the most bizarre scene of the film. And in a film where there's already so much surreal set pieces going on, this is quite the stretch. What goes on is Patrick Stewart is tied down to a table after being injected with God knows how much morphine or diazepam or whatever they seek to inject in him. And he starts talking with Matilda May's voice mixed with Patrick Stewart's own voice. So you get this somewhat comical scene in which Steve Railsback is trying to get the space vampire out of his soul by basically saying, come on out, you bitch, you know, I want to face you myself, even though half the dreams involve him making out with her in gloriously Skinamax fashion. And just hearing Patrick Stewart's voice, along with this woman's voice saying, I love you, to Steve Railsback, is utterly bizarre. It must have been a hilarious scene to film.
I always imagined, after they yelled cut, Patrick Stewart's like, get off me.
Especially considering Steve Railsback has pulled in with essentially the erotic version of the Force to just give Patrick Stewart the biggest smooch of his life, causing lightning and shit to just move everywhere across the screen.
Somebody out there finds this hot.
I bet someone does. It's probably the makings of fanfic authors everywhere. Mind you, apparently Patrick Stewart really enjoyed working with Toby Hooper. In fact, he says that out of all the directors he's worked with, Toby Hooper was probably his favourite. I don't know, maybe because the scenes probably were so fun to film, he was like, wow, this is amazing. I may be only in for 15 minutes, but fuck it, this is amazing. This is going to be art. And then he would go on to make Star Trek The Next Generation. Certainly a step up, I suppose, in terms of quote-unquote quality, but fuck it, this film's amazing, who cares? Then we got this, and straight after this scene where you have lightning and props being shoved to and from the place, you have Patrick Stewart's body taken on a helicopter, to which arguably my favourite special effect in the film occurs, where essentially the female space vampire jumps out of his body, but not by any other means, not like just literally her jumping out of the corpse or her soul pouring out blood, just lots of hemoglobin just pours out of Patrick Stewart's mouth, forming this bloodied corpse version of Matilda May's character, to which she then just slumps into a pool of blood and viscera in the ground. Again, wonderful use of practical effects. I mean, just the floating aspect, I mean, it looks like CGI, but it's clearly not, so I have to wonder, how did they get that bizarre rotating motion with the blood effects? I'd love to know, because, again, Canon showing their budget off pretty successfully.
Yeah, especially when you want to know how they achieved an effect. It's good for, you know, filmmakers who want to know how to do it themselves.
There was a documentary, a making of, that was made of this, but it's only on Laserdisc along with the making of Invaders from Mars. It's on the same disc. It's only a 20-minute long documentary, but it's only available on that format, bizarrely. You'd think they would at least put it on a DVD, or perhaps, as some people have demanded, believe it or not, a future Blu-ray. Considering MGM is in this bizarre financial state, I think a lot of these Canon films at least deserve some form of high-def treatment, because very few, if any of them, really have proper high-def transfers.
It would be nice to see Life Force on Blu-ray, especially with all of the special effects and the way it's shot. It would really benefit, and I most certainly would pick it up.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very nice-looking film, especially considering the production company behind it. Some of the visuals, I think, are genuinely gorgeous in places. During a final set piece where essentially all hell breaks loose, the three space vampires take over so much of London's population that it pretty much turns into space vampire slash zombie apocalypse mayhem, as everybody is sucking energy out of everybody on the city streets. And you see these strands of lightning swish and swoosh across the sky, and explosions just tearing up the entire place. I mean, I think there was a set that was deliberately constructed to look exactly like a London Underground station, and you watch as wind machines, smoke machines, and everybody just flies around the screen with reckless abandon. It's a great looking film, that's the thing. So, again, we could heap praise on the actual effects all we'd like, but I think one thing we've got to talk about, really, it's probably the showstopper for me at times, the acting. Because the acting from the cast is, I think, to say it in one word, bizarre. Put simply, we've got to talk about Steve Railsback here, our main protagonist, our hero. Atypical of typical, you know, modern-day action heroes in these kinds of 80s fare, science fiction or otherwise, he's not really a tough guy. He essentially has two moods, moody and somewhat stoic, not really saying very much, to schizophrenic and completely mad, oftentimes within the same scene, sometimes within about 10 seconds of each other. I mean, the scene when he's coaxing the female space vampire out of Patrick Stewart is him just madly shouting and slapping Patrick Stewart on this table, almost like the guy is about to have a fit on stage. Then again, he seems to be just incredibly frightened of Matilda May's character, which again, I find hilarious, because in half the scenes, he's like, oh my god, I love her because she's so attractive, oh my god, I couldn't stop. I mean, the part where it shows a flashback of him on the space shuttle before he gets off and leaves the dead crew behind, the dead crew's life force somehow being absorbed by the vampires without them getting out of their crystal cases. doesn't really make any sense, but then again, not a lot of this film does. And there's a part where he begins to snog her, and the crystal case disappears. Just no reason at all, it just happens. And then the next scene, he'll be batshit scared of her. Literally, the dream where she comes to his bed in the form of a prop vampire bat, which then just turns into her with this bizarre-looking cloak. And, you know, they're having a bit of rumpy-pumpy, and then he wakes up screaming, like, just... See, the scream is so loud and hilarious because he doesn't just scream, but he has to emphasize it so much that he screams, then takes a breath, and then screams again. I showed one of my friends this over Skype, a guy called Mitch, and he was pissing himself over that, just that god. One scene. Oh my god. And then, I've got to let you talk about some of your favourite scenes of the film, because really, this could have gone, this podcast could easily just go the way of describing the entire film, because really, because the film has this bizarre dreamlike incoherence to it, it's kind of difficult to not go into the intricacies of the film. I mean, come on, there's got to be some highlights from you.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I don't think we've mentioned it yet, but of course, one thing that I think everyone who's seen the movie talks about is that, like, the first, 30, 50 minutes of the movie, we just see Matilda May walking
around. Yeah, she literally just wanders around very slowly, very just assuredly, wandering around with everybody around her just going, "Stop! Look, there's a naked woman!" Or they either try to ogle her, or are bizarrely scared of her, or are pushed back by her force powers or whatever.
Or as I like to say, a lot of them have a dull surprise.
Yeah, they just don't seem to mind. They're just sort of like, oh, a naked chick wandering around the base. This is perfectly normal. One of the highlights for me when she's escaping is she essentially gets hold of one of the doctors. I can never remember his name, but I just sort of recognize him because he has this unnervingly groggy, really tired voice, and his neck is always slanted in every single scene. He is almost killed with a female space vampire. And he goes up to the main doctor called Dr. Hans Falada, who somehow knows everything about the space vampires, because he just does, because he is a British doctor and therefore knows everything. And he says, "I was attacked by her." And then Peter Firth, as Cade, says, "Did you feel any sexual impulses towards her?" And he goes, "Yes, very much so. It was very disturbing." And then he goes, I'm feeling very nauseous right now. I just find that hilarious because I'm thinking, you're feeling nauseous over Matilda May? Total closet case.
Definitely.
Seriously.
I guess the other thing, one of my favorite scenes in the movie is, it's near the end, but it's probably my favorite special effect is, I fucking forget the character's name, but he's got I wouldn't say stake, like a sword or something. It's the sword, right? Yeah.
Yeah, Kane picks up this bizarre sword prop thing that Dr. Hans Falada had delivered him. Before we get into that, the scene where this sword first appears, Dr. Hans Falada just gets this bizarre package in the mail, and it's just this sword for no reason. Peter, you know, is played by Peter Finlay, and he just goes, "Oh, by the way, I have this sword," foreshadowing. So yes, Kane gets the sword and throws it at a male space vampire played bizarrely.
You have to stab them below the heart.
Yeah,
it's slightly different.
Yeah, below the heart, because there's some kind of artificial brain storage center thing that never goes completely unexplained.
It's basically lazy writing, where it's like, we can't make it the heart that just makes these vampires, so we'll make it.
Yeah, they like
the
to
heart.
Vary between the descriptions of these people or creatures, as they call them. Sometimes they just call them creatures, sometimes they call them aliens, sometimes they call them vampires.
it's just craziness. And for the scene that stole the show for me is when he has that sword and he's about to go and, well, basically get rid of Matilda May and the other guy. I always forget their fucking name.
Steve Railsback.
Steve Railsback. So he goes there. It's like a church, I believe. And one of the space vampires, one of the males, just appears. And he stabs him. And he transforms into this enormous bat-winged creature thing.
Yeah, it totally looks
like 5 seconds.
It totally looks like the first boss out of Castlevania.
Well, that's what, and I think we said last time, is that we would have loved to have seen a Castlevania movie by Canon, because with all the special effects they got, if they got the same budget, it could have been interesting.
I mean, bearing in mind, Tobe Hooper wanted this to essentially be his tribute to Hammer Horror Pictures, and, you know, we were discussing that if we were to make a Castlevania movie, we'd essentially have, like, Hammer Horror-style aesthetics with perhaps Ray Harryhausen-style stop-motion and animatronics, that kind of thing. Life Force somewhat has that bizarre vibe.
I see, because with the Monster Madness going on, James Rolfe has been talking about the Nightmare movies, and I've actually forgotten about how fun those movies are to watch, and especially, well, the stop motion and puppetry, I guess you could say, for those movies. And I really miss, artificial effects, puppetry, animatronics, claymation, because we use so much CGI nowadays, it kind of defeats the purpose.
Well, again, those kinds of props and aesthetics have a very physical... they're very physical. They have weight to them. So, for example, within the scene in Life Force, when the space vampire metamorphoses into this creature, you know, it's an actor looking at this prop as it's moving around with all of these bizarre lightning effects coursing through the background.
Yeah, yeah, and again, like we said, the budget really shows in this movie, because the special effects are, even to this day... are very effective.
There's the odd bit of occasionally wonky green screen in some of the space scenes of the astronauts, but again, that they're like one or two shots that are very few and far between. Most of it is surprisingly well handled in terms of the actual budget and just the way the film looks. I mean, this film never really got much of a decent treatment on home video. It's got a widescreen release on DVD, but much like most of Canon's films, they haven't really been remastered to a particularly well-managed degree. And even before it was released in video, the original theatrical cut, 20 minutes were cut out of the final version. This film is just under 2 hours, fairly long for a Canon film, and the original work print was over 2 hours. But for the original theatrical release, they edited this down to just over an hour and a half, and replaced some of Henry Mancini's score with a soundtrack by Michael Carmen, the guy who did the background score for Highlander.
Ha, that's a weird coincidence.
Yeah, admittedly, Michael Carmen's score isn't that far off Mancini's anyway. It's just a bit more eerie. It's got more of a Jerry Goldsmith alien vibe to it, I suppose you could say.
Mm-hmm. But, jeez, what else could we talk about? The thing is, this movie really blows your mind.
Yes, like I said, it's just under 2 hours, but it packs so much into it in terms of not just effects and the amount of characters, because the cast is fairly large for a Canon film, and they tried to hire people who in Britain were fairly recognisable or unknown and would go on to be fairly famous. Like I said, Peter Firth was in the BBC series Spooks, which is actually about to end on TV. You have Patrick Stewart in an early role. This wasn't that long after he was in John Borman's Excalibur. A good couple of years after that. Then you have Peter Finlay, and you have Steve Rails back, and just random people like that. And the fact that this was a Canon film made in Britain makes it, I suppose, even more unique, because most Canon films are just set in, you know, ubiquitous locations like New York, Los Angeles, although most of the time they are filmed in London anyway. Look at Death Wish 3, that was filmed in the Docklands. But this is a very, very British film, and it just shows. It, to me, watching this film is like watching Tobe Hooper do Alfred Hitchcock's Frenzy, because everybody's got those hilariously overwrought regional accents that for some reason these 70s and 80s movies always seem to be around, and I always find intrinsically amusing. I may be a British person, but God, some of those posh accents make me laugh, especially from some of the soldiers. So they're basically like, oh no, we've got to stop the contagion, we've got to stop these space vampires from taking over the city of London. There's even a moment where Steve Railsback and Peter Firth go to find the Prime Minister, and the Prime Minister turns out to be a space vampire who immediately sucks the life force out of his female assistant just behind their backs. Literally in the span of 30 seconds he goes, oh, I'm not feeling very well, ah, bzzz, lightning going everywhere. Stuff just happens randomly. It literally would be a scene, it's like main characters enter stage, something happens, something that happens doesn't really have to have a consequence to the narrative. Okay, let's just move that to the end of the narrative so you can then explain through some exposition that still doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. Just the conversation between Peter Firth and Finlay's character, Dr. Hans Falada, about the afterlife, which said, do you believe in the afterlife? No. Do you want to know what happens? No. Oh, okay then. Just sometimes the dialogue of the film just goes nowhere. Or again, non-sequiturs come out of nowhere. Again, Peter Firth as Kane, there's a part where Steve Railsback corners a woman who the space vampire has taken over, and Steve Railsback is slapping her around, proper full-on round-the-world slap, like
this.
Hikaru and Minmay in the Macross movie, and Kane just sits back on the chair and says, "Don't worry, I'm a natural voyeur." And I'm like, "Oh, okay. That's a interesting thing to say about your character. I like violence against women. Okay, fair enough."
I just line in the entire film.
It's probably the best line, because it, not like the most of this movie, it comes out of nowhere and just, it's supposed to be a line which says something about his character, but just comes off as, well, darkly comedic. Really, much of this film does, because of its weird idiosyncrasies with the space vampires as creatures, the fact that automatically halfway through the narrative the ship suddenly starts to move and send out some kind of weird signal thing so that Matilda May's character can be just instantly inside St. Paul's Cathedral, transmitting the energy that is absorbed by all the other space vampires, which were originally human, who somehow were able to catch this contagion, which somehow spread around the... It doesn't matter. Really, it doesn't. Shit just happens.
Really, the whole movie is kind of a clusterfuck of, like you said, inconsistencies. But, like Leonard Maltin, who gives a fuck?
Because it's done with verve. The film never really slows down. It always has verve to it, I suppose you could say. Every scene, they try their best to take it seriously. I suppose if this was a film where they tried to be deliberately campy or tried to make it too tongue-in-cheek, then that might have wrecked the pacing of the film. The fact that they treat the source material with such deadly sincerity, it makes it all the more enjoyable. I mean, to be fair, the original book, I've read about half of it, is fairly pulpy to begin with. Although they do try to explain in a bit more detail about the origins of the space vampires, like, they somewhat imply in this movie version that, okay, the space vampires might have come many thousands of years ago to the planet Earth, whereas in the book it's explicitly stated by the Dr. Hans Vallada character that, yes, they are essentially the brothers and sisters of our ancestors that came to Earth and essentially indoctrinated certain people into their species to be passed over hundreds and hundreds of years. Really silly, pulpy stuff, but I think it's really enjoyable. And I like it when films and books do that, when they're like, okay, we have this silly concept, but we'll just go with them and see what happens.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I can't think of a good example off the top of my head, but now that I've seen the movie, I'm actually very interested in at least checking out the book. For some reason, I have a feeling I'll just find a copy for like a quarter at my...
You could probably find it. I mean, the book was released in several versions. Right around the time the film was released, the book's name was changed to Life Force. I have that version, but most commonly you'll just find it under the title The Space Vampires. And it's a short book. It's only around 200 pages. You know, it's a very quick pick-up-and-read kind of novel. Very simple, very basic. I mean, other minor changes that are a bit odd as well is the fact that Steve Railsback's character, Carson, in the book, is much older. He's 45 years old, which I suppose was meant to be the groggy doctor character in the movie, but I suppose they just changed it to Steve Railsback because he looks younger. I'm guessing he's in his 30s, but I don't know if this is just me with movies, but I always find it oddly uncomfortable when it's like a man who's clearly about 10 years older than the woman he wants to have sex with, you know, in courtship. I just find that a bit odd. Maybe that's just because I kind of wish I was in Steve Railsback's position throughout the entire movie. But alas, I just find it always a bit odd. You know, I know it's meant to be really erotic and, you know, set with a really dark, moody lighting, but I just sort of come across as, I don't know, isn't he a bit old for you, lady? And besides, he's sort of, Steve Railsback is kind of a plain Jane kind of dude. He doesn't really have anything that says, yeah, I want him. He's just kind of has this sort of like, yeah... I'm an 80s dude. To be honest, he kind of looks like someone out of the old Battlestar Galactica TV series. He definitely isn't, but he just kind of reminds me of Richard Hatch for some reason. Maybe it's just the hair. I don't know.
I could see that, actually. He does kind of bear a resemblance.
I know, maybe
Richard
he'd
Hatch.
Look good in one of those fetching brown jumpsuits.
God, now I want to watch Battlestar Galactica. Good thing I have the complete
series.
Same
here. Why didn't the new Battlestar Galactica put in space vampires? That would have been epic. I try to think as well, what's some other crazy things I can think of with this movie? Because again, it's basically a laundry list. You could just go through almost every single scene and pick stuff out. Okay, right, I'll go back to the scene where Carlson has this dream sequence where Matilda May's space vampire intercepts him in the dream. And the sound effects used during sex is so bizarre. You hear these ghostly, childish screams, which I suppose if you really wanted to be pretentious like me, you could interpret it as their courtship essentially forming like a demonic child, possibly. I mean, that's never followed up, but that would have been kind of interesting if there was a cliffhanger where it turns out that, oh no, there is a mystical space vampire baby or something, like, I don't know. Like a less weird version of Necromantic or something.
There is a crazy scene that I actually wrote down that I had to mention, because the last time we recorded, I mentioned it the last minute after recording. One of the victims of Matilda May's life sucking, I guess you could say, the female with the orange hair. You know where I'm going with this.
Oh yeah, the scene where, in her bizarre skeletal mode, she writhes around on this operating table, again with these wonderfully ghastly sound effects of her rasping and breathing as the animatronics essentially performing this seizure on the table.
And one thing that I remember just staring at, just pondering as to why, is because if you guys remember from our Anatomy of Hell review, Ollie complained about, and I agree with, the fact that the woman had not shaved. Whereas for some reason, I have no idea why, I guess they want to get a little more detailed, they have the most obnoxious pubic hair for this woman.
Yeah, like you described to me before in passing, it was essentially like someone took one of those toy trolls, ripped their hair off, and just sort of glued it on. Yep, there we go. Just make sure it's a woman, even though you can clearly tell it is, because it's still got boobs. Mind you, of Anatomy of...
Very small ones now.
Mind you, of Anatomy of Hell, when I meant that she hadn't shaved, I kind of meant the armpits, but I suppose you could interpret that, because goddamn, that woman's... God, it was like staring into a Wookiee's face. God. There you go.
Now I'm thinking of all the fucking scenes. Did she give birth to an eggplant?
Thank God the zombie didn't give birth to an eggplant. Oh my God. I don't think he... I'm not sure if even canon could get away with that, but they did get away with a ton of weird shit in Death Wish 2, so I suppose anything is possible.
God, you're speaking so much of these Death Wish movies, I gotta see them for myself.
Charles Bronson will blow your fucking mind. Come on. Mind you, I'm surprised Charles Bronson wasn't in this movie. In fact, no. Speaking of Bronson films, Michael Winner, the director of the first three Death Wish films, was originally going to make this. And I have to wonder, already this film is pretty insane, and while it is directed by Tobe Hooper, who is American, and clearly having a love for the Hammer Horror, Quatermass, and the Pit style of movies, I have to wonder what Michael Winner's version of this would have been like, seeing as how he was British, and naturally would have also probably have grown up on the Hammer Horror Fair. What could have it possibly been like, I wonder?
Well, only time will tell, I guess.
Loads of people have interviewed that guy over the years. I mean, I don't know if there's many interviews of Tobe Hooper, but Michael Winner, you know, he always talks about the Death Wish films in an interview when there's stuff about censorship or whatever, especially here in Britain. You know, he'll always talk about how, oh yes, these films were censored in my country and, you know, all that good stuff. You know, I can't say I blame him. I just wish there was more information about this film, though, Life Force, because there just doesn't seem to be very much. I mean, when people think of the biggest flops in Hollywood history, you know, the usual suspects come to mind. Ishtar, Cleopatra, Heaven's Gate, Popeye, Sorcerer by William Friedkin. But Life Force is never mentioned, and I'm not saying that's because it's a bad film, because to be honest, it may be almost incoherent, but I love the hell out of this film. And yet, no one talks about it. And yet it didn't make that much money and was heavily advertised at the time here in the UK because of the mainly British cast and, in, to some respect, some of the crew who worked on it. It got a lot of hype. It got a lot of press, which is why it's more well known here than in the United States.
Yeah, I guess it's more of a cultish thing over here. And speaking of cults, didn't you say there's actually a fan base for this?
Yes, film? I decided to search just out of pure interest on Google about the film in terms of video releases and what have you. And there have been several forums on different websites, you know, asking for Blu-ray releases, hoping there's a remastered widescreen print or whatever. There are people who really enjoy the film. Can't say I blame them. But There is a fan base for this film. It is around. Then again, I think with any canon film, there is at least a tiny fan base relating to them. I mean, like I said, when I went to go see Masters of the Universe in a cinema on a 35mm print, 300 people turned up to watch it. So, you know, there are people out there who wouldn't mind seeing this get a proper release. Yeah. To be honest, I'm surprised even Masters of the Universe hasn't even gotten a Blu-ray yet. That 35mm print looked so good, I actually think that would have been really cool. But again, veering off topic.
God, I feel like the only person that did not like
it. Well, don't worry, I'm sure I'll dump that on you soon enough. I think one of the other things that really... One of the other things that also just had a bizarre impact on me in the film, as I briefly mentioned at the beginning, the score for the film by Henry Mancini, the guy who did the score for The Pink Panther and quite a few other movies. Again, just to the opening bit of music, which is also used in the closing credits, it's been featured on several science fiction best of albums, and it's easy to hear why. It's an amazing bit of orchestral scoring, and it just seems so weird that it comes from this film.
Wasn't it on some kind of record with Star Trek and Star Wars scores?
Yes, it was on like a 4-disc set called the Science Fiction Album, which one of the many Philharmonic orchestras remade the orchestral scores for certain films. And yeah, the CD features Star Wars, Star Trek, Metropolis, Total Recall, Moonraker, and yet it also features this, which is interesting. And I just listened to the musical score before I watched the film. And again, it surprised me because I was expecting sort of synthesizer plinky plonky Jimmy Page type stuff. But again, it does not make you feel like you're watching a Golden Globus production. And then again, Superman 4 also has an orchestral score, but you know.
Yeah. Wow, this movie just, it makes a brain fart, like, you can't even, like, your brain becomes incoherent, ironically.
It does. I mean, it's arguably the craziest film canon has produced, and, you know, they have made a fair few bizarre things. I mean, I remember railing onto you about, of course, the legend that is Kinjite Forbidden Subjects, another Bronson classic, and that is pretty batshit insane, but that doesn't feature space vampires. I mean, to me, that's just the way I sell this movie to people. I go up to my friends and say, hey guys, I just watched this movie called Life Force. And they said, oh yeah, what's it about? Space vampires. And they just sort of look at me with this blank stare going, okay. I mean, come on. We live in a generation in which everyone is seemingly brought up on Twilight and what have you. And it just makes me think, what about stuff like this or the Hammer horror movies? You know, the stuff where, you know, vampires, you know, they may be treated with somewhat a level of bizarre lore, weird ideas, but they're enjoyable. They don't make you cringe. Especially not this. In fact, if all honesty, I was just watching this film, and half of the film I was just going, what the fuck, in a good way?
Yeah, yeah, and the funny thing is, that was the selling point to me, was that Ollie just simply said, space vampires. I was like, sold, I'm gonna watch this.
Well, then again, admittedly, you're sold on many things, but the fact I sold you on just two words, I think speaks volumes about the quality of the film.
Well, who wouldn't want to watch a movie with something like space vampires? It's the kind of thing you wouldn't imagine, you know, putting together. It's like, God, I can't even think of a good example.
Come on, there's space vampires, one of them being a gorgeous naked French woman. You've got hilariously schizophrenic overacting, vampire zombie apocalypses in the street. You have giant weird-looking spaceships that look like umbrellas mixed with H.R. Giger Hammer horror-style architecture. You've got a great orchestral score. You've got London exploding. You've got Patrick Stewart in it because, well, he just is. In fact, that's admittedly one of the reasons some people do remember the film. They just go, oh, Patrick Stewart was in it. I don't really remember anything else. I was talking to Paul Chapman, the host of the Greatest Movie Ever podcast, and I mentioned we got to talk about this movie, and he said, I watched this many years ago, and I completely forgot about it. And I said, how the hell could you forget about this movie? I mean, I pretty much sold him to it as, look, if you watch it again, I promise you'll remember everything.
Wow. Him? Really?
Yeah, I mean, he's a big canon Golden Globus fan like myself, so for him to not really remember this film is weird. In fact, you know what? I've recently guest starred on the All Gen Gamers podcast again. Johnny, Happy Console Gamer, has this film. I took it out with everyone. I said, hey guys, do you know of Life Force? And Johnny said, holy shit, I know what that movie is. And I'm like, rock on, air five over the microphone. But yeah, you know, some people don't know the film who you'd think would know about it, and then people you'd think had would have no idea what you're talking about somehow know what it is.
Well, much more respect to Johnny. I love that guy.
Yeah, this film just has this bizarre effect on people. I know critics despise it, except for Leonard Maltin, really, and there's like one other person, I think, on Rotten Tomatoes, who said it's incoherent but incredibly enjoyable. Most people despise it. I mean, I'm sure, you know, the Siskel and Ebert kind of crowd will probably be like, oh no, it doesn't make any sense, but, you know, I don't enjoy it because blah, 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 blah. But again, nobody talks about it, and I wish the fan base on this was bigger, because this is the biggest budgeted canon film ever made, really. So, why? Why doesn't it have more of a following? Why can't it have the same following as something like Death Wish 3 or The Delta Force or something? I mean, I'm surprised.
Well, I think it's one of their best films, and again, my favorite of all the canon films that I have seen. And remember, that's not a whole lot. So far, I think that's just 4.
I mean, mind you, this somehow beat Robotech the movie as my second favourite canon film, and that's something we'll also need to cover purely on the basis of the fact that it makes no goddamn sense. But that's definitely one for another time. Seriously, I think we might as well, at some point, just have a whole season in which we just cherry-pick canon films to dump on each other at some point.
Yeah, definitely, since I want to catch up on some more canon. This bastard just keeps sending me trailers to movies that I simply just go, dude, I gotta watch that.
Yeah, I mean, the 80s canon stuff, or canon schlock, whatever you want to call them, is just full of gems and crazy things that you wouldn't believe have ever existed until now. Life Force being one of them. So I suppose if I was to finish off this episode in a manner that was not that much more coherent than the film's narrative as well, it's an amazing piece of sci-fi kitsch. Yes, as we've said many, many times, it doesn't make a lot of sense. But if you're willing to forgo a complete lack of logic and look at it from both a technical and perhaps just an entertainment standpoint, I suppose you could say, unless you have a heart of coal, this is one of the most enjoyable science fiction films you could probably see that came out of the 1980s. It's just, it's a smorgasbord of absolute batshit insanity. And I adore it. I think it's amazing. And to get it on DVD for £3 is a crime. Someone released on Blu-ray. Come on. MGM, get your financial shit together and start releasing canon films on Blu-ray. I'll buy them. Day one. Every single last one of them.
I have a feeling some independent company in the UK is going to start releasing canon films on Blu-ray.
Well, someone's just got to buy the rights from MGM. I mean, they don't know what the hell they're doing. Ever since they were bought by Sony, Sony are like, okay, we'll put out something occasionally on DVD, and there's the James Bond films, which are in eternal purgatory, seemingly, with Blu-ray. Someone buy the canon films. Please, anybody. I mean, Warner Brothers own a couple of the canon films, like Cobra, and what's another one that comes to mind?
Yeah, and Cobra's a fucking Blu-ray, for Christ's sake.
Yeah, Cobra's on Blu-ray. I mean, and that's a canon film. That's a Golden Globus movie. So why not anything else? So yeah, someone, get your shit together and get these movies out in high def. I want to see them, and I'm sure a lot of other people want to as well. I mean, those 35mm prints, you know, I'd love to see more of them shown in cinemas, but God knows how many of them have probably gone lost to the mists of time. This, I have a bad feeling, probably being one of them.
Well, hey, you know, maybe if I don't see Life Force released on Blu-ray in the near future, we'll have to buy the rights to release it ourselves.
Again, the same thing with Macross. Then again, it's weird with these kinds of movies, because they're either really expensive to buy the licenses for, or probably very cheap. It's very difficult to tell.
I have a gut feeling Life Force might be very cheap.
I suppose. Maybe it's sort of one of those Lost Horizon things where nobody really, really wants it anymore. And by that, I mean the 70s version of that movie, which my mum inexplicably loves. Again, my mum is like me. She really likes a lot of these weird films that nobody else likes but herself or myself.
Yeah.
So, I mean, do you have any particular final thoughts on this masterpiece from Tobe Hooper, the same luminary who brought us Texas Chainsaw Massacre 1 and 2, another canon movie, with Dennis Hopper?
And Poltergeist. Final thoughts, it's fucking awesome. I can't recommend it as much. I mean, come on. I think Ollie sold it for all of us. This movie is, yeah, it's incoherent, but who gives a fuck? It's, I mean, this is coming from a guy who thinks, you know, the Transformers movies are good entertainment for the same reason. It's incoherent, but loads of fun. And Life Force is definitely in that same vein. And, if you, again, if you can find it, you'll probably find it very cheap. It's worth every penny. And it's just, it's good. Just get it. It's, your collection isn't complete without it. I'm sorry.
Especially if you're into science fiction or space operas or sci-fi horror films in the same vein as Alien. This should be a staple of film clubs everywhere. I mean, if you're... Okay, you start a film club, it should be compulsory that you have this or something like Deadly Prey somewhere. Just show it to people. Blow their minds. Take them down the chip shop, get them pissed on beer and curry, and you're away. You're done.
Yeah, and again, I'll use the exact same phrase that Ollie used on me and sold me. Space, vampires, the end. Did we stop recording?
No, it didn't stop recording, no.
Alright. Well, I guess that's it for this podcast. Quite an interesting one, I guess you could say.
Oh, absolutely. I'm glad I picked this one, seeing as how I hadn't seen it before
and
you hadn't seen
it
before
either.
I'm glad
you picked it for me.
It's a damn good one.
I'm a better man now that I've seen Life Force. I'm a natural voyeur.
Indeed. And with that, guys, we will be signing off once again, as usual, despite the incredibly long delays with putting up an actual movie episode. We'll say again, if you want to contact us via Facebook, you can at the Welcome to the Brain Palace page. Leave comments down below under the episodes. Send us PMs on our prerequisite YouTube accounts or whatever. You know, give us some feedback and spread the space vampire love. Just do it. You'll be a greater man for it.
Yes, and always check geekee.com, G33K-E.com for updates. I write articles, and the podcast episodes tend to go up a little earlier on that site. So, with that again, thanks for listening, and see you next time.
Take care.